I resist. I do not know where it comes from. What deep-seated instinct or subconscious component of my being precipitates the apathy? But for all the truth and truthful desperation of Dame Guaidra's plea, I resist her call to arms. She is correct in everything she said. I do not doubt that, had I stayed in Hans proper, the church or the lairds would have caught up with me and brought me to an untimely and painful end. I do not doubt Dawson's words that the brothers of Chapel Abel knew the truth of the highwaymen and were prepared to capture or kill me. I have seen Abelican justice before. I do not doubt that the Dame of Vanguard is desperate or that her people are suffering terribly under the weight of encroaching hordes, bounded, as they are Samhaste-driven, by no moral constraints. And still, I resist. I have seen the result of the troll raids. A town burned to the ground, every soul slaughtered. I am revolted and repulsed and angered to my heart and soul. I feel Dame Guaidra's outrage and her desperation and know that if she felt anything different, she would be a lesser person. I see her trembling with outrage, not because of the tentative nature of her survival and title, but because she truly feels for those people who look to her for leadership. That alone, I know, elevates her high above the average laird of Hans proper. And still, I resist. Who am I? I thought I knew. For all my life, the answer was so self-evident that I never bothered to ask the question. At least not in this manner. The Book of Jest and the Gemstones freed me from my infirmities and redefined me in a physical sense. That much is obvious. But now I come to know that the blessing of the inner healing is forcing upon me a second remaking. Or at the very least, a very basic questioning of this man I am, this man I have become. Who am I? And what am I beyond the confines of my strengthened flesh? Quite contrary to my expectations, this strengthening, this healing, has led me to a more uncomfortable place. It has forced upon me a sense of obligation and responsibility for others. For others. For all of my youth and into early adulthood, there were few others. And those, Garibond, some few brothers of the Chapel Pride, Kaydale, on those occasions when I was graced with her presence, were important to me almost exclusively because of what they could do for me. They were in the life of Branson Garibond because Branson Garibond needed them. It is difficult for me to admit there was something comfortable and comforting in my infirmities. While the other young men were competing in this game we call life, whether simply running against each other, or seeing who could throw a rock the furthest, or in the more formal competitions to gain a position in the church or in the court of the laird, I was excluded. It wasn't even an option. There was pain in that exclusion, to be sure, but I would be a liar if I didn't admit that there was also a measure of comfort. I did not have to compete in the endless battles to determine the hierarchy of the boys my age. I did not have to suffer the embarrassment of being honestly beaten, because no one could beat the stork honestly. My infirmity was no dodge, of course, but I cannot be certain that I would have eschewed a dodge had I needed one. I cannot make that claim because I never had to face that choice. Then, suddenly, I was freed of that infirmity. Suddenly, I became the highwayman. Even in that identity, I cannot claim purity of intent or righteousness of motive. Who did the highwayman truly serve in his battle with the powers that were in pride holding? The people? Or did he serve the highwayman? The world of the highwaymen is not as simple as that of the stork. Branson Garibond.
Cormac convulsed and slid back from the deep darkness of unconsciousness. He felt wet along one side and sensed that his lower legs were floating. The first image that registered to him was that of a glacial troll face not far from his own, the creature hanging on the side of a small boat and forcing its edge under the water to swamp it. He rolled up to his elbow facing the troll, reached across with his left hand, and grabbed the creature by its scraggly hair. He kept rolling, using his weight to push that ugly head back, then turned under, rolling his shoulder and hopping to his knees, thus driving the troll's head forward and down. The troll cracked its chin on the side rail, but slid over so that Cormac's weight had it pinned on the rail by its neck. Up leaped the man. The quick movement freed him enough to lift one leg and stomp down hard on the troll. The boat rocked, and Cormac had to work hard to hold his balance. The aft was almost underwater, lifting the prow into the air. Cormac started to turn back that way when he noted a troll scrambling over the prow and coming down at him. He feigned obliviousness until the last second, then jammed his elbow back. Cormac was out of time, and he knew it, for yet another troll appeared at the low-riding raft. When the creature pushed up onto that rail, the rear of the boat submerged, water flooding in. Cormac turned and scrambled to the high-riding prow, trying to counteract the weight and lift the rear. He was too late. So he went to the very tip of the prow, glanced around quickly, and dove away. He counted on surprise, for though he was a strong swimmer, he certainly couldn't outdistance glacial trolls in the water. But he had to try. He swam for his life, legs and arms pumping furiously. Cormac had shed his heavy robe as soon as he hit the water, and wore only the knee-length white pants and sleeveless shirt typical for his order. That and a stubborn powry cap, which clung to his head as if by magic. Cormac knew that he had put about 15 long strides between himself and the troll and its companions. He tried to do logical estimates of the remaining distance at the small island he had spotted. He could only pray that his dive had surprised the vile creatures and that he would find the island quickly. Good fortune showed him that the island wasn't as far as he had believed, not nearly. But on the flip side of that revelation was the knowledge that what he had taken to be an island was really no more than a couple of large rocks protruding above the water. Cormac crawled up onto it anyway, having little choice, for the trolls were not far behind. The monk moved to the highest point, crawling on all fours, and found a loose rock on his way. He pivoted and threw with all his strength, smacking a troll right in the face. Cormac seized the opportunity, skipping down and launching a barrage of punches and kicks on the troll. He had to break away, though, as another exited the water. It slashed at him with claw-like fingers, but the monk was too quick, leaning out of range as he squared up. Another troll broke the water, closing in savagely. Cormac snapped a fast kick at the first troll. Cormac settled once more into a defensive posture against its furious companion. While the troll was scratching and stinging him, Cormac was inflicting real damage, and the clutch lasted only a matter of a few seconds before the troll crumpled before him. Cormac slumped to his knees on the stone. He tried to take a survey of his wounds, which included many deep cuts from claws and teeth. He knew that he had to get down to the water to cleanse them, but he simply didn't have the strength at that moment. He was certain that if just one more troll crawled out of the lake, he would surely be doomed. The sun climbed higher in the eastern sky. The minutes became an hour, then two. The hot waters of Mithranadun fought back the cold chill of Alpinador. At last, Cormac managed to get down to the water and cleaned his wounds and drank deeply. He knelt there, letting his mind whirl through the events that had brought him to this desolate place. The memories of his last hours at Chapel Isle flooded back to him, and he looked again upon the deep disappointment etched into the face of Father de Gilb and even the regret evident in Giavno's voice, even as the man had scourged him senseless. There was no going back. His banishment was not a trial or a penance. It represented finality and not forgiveness. There was no going back. Cormac was alone in the middle of a lake full of monsters and trolls, surrounded by enemies. He looked at the steamy waters, and for a few moments he hoped that a group of trolls would rise up from the depths and overwhelm him. For in those dark hours, Cormac's future loomed before him, empty and terrifying. He peered out into the direction from which he had come. hoping against all logic that he'd see his boat out there, capsized but floating. He knew it would not be so. Trolls were expert at destroying craft when they put their minds to it, and the best he could reasonably hope for would be a splinter or a plank washing up against the empty little piece of rock. Cormac thought back to his fateful decision to free Andrusis and the others, the choice that had landed him here, battered and sure to die. For a moment, he regretted his choice, but only for a moment.
I did the right thing. Father de Gilb was wrong. They were all wrong.
He turned south and a bit to the east that he might be somewhat facing Chapel Isle.
You were wrong! You are wrong! Faith is not coerced. It cannot be. It blossoms within. Truth revealed in the heart and soul. You are wrong!
Cormac turned and saw his Abelican robe bobbing in the water against the stones. He retrieved it and laid it out on the stones to dry, and in doing so, he took note of his powery beret still set firmly on his head. He put his hand up to touch it. There was indeed some magic within that cap. Cormac looked to the troll bite on one arm to find that it was well on the way to healing, showing no signs of infection. He considered the deep wounds on his back from the whipping. He should not have survived those without tending, and yet he had come through them, floating alone in a boat. The beret, Cormac knew in his heart. The powery beret somehow acted in a manner similar to the soul stone and was possessed of magic. There lay a common thread here, he knew. From the Powrys to the Alpinadorian shamans to the Abelicans and even the Samhastes, there lay a common magic, a bonding of purpose and power.
A singular god for all?
His stomach roared with hunger when he awoke the next morning. He gulped down the lake water to try to quell the emptiness. Face down near the water, hands cupping it and bringing it up to his dry lips, Cormac nearly fell over when he saw the troll right behind him. He fell back, scrambling to find some defensive posture, and cut his elbows and knees in his desperate thrashing before he finally realized that it was one of the dead ones from the day before, bobbing high in the water. Cormac splashed into his waist and came beside the troll. He dared to push down on it to try to force it under the waves, and was amazed at its buoyancy. He glanced back at his empty island, certain to be his grave site. He looked out to Mithranadun and saw another dead and floating troll.
Is it possible?
Was it possible? They came in through a variety of means, either running with steps magically lightened and lengthened, or in the form of a fast cat, or even, in the case of the older and more powerful, in the form of birds flying across the mountain updrafts. They came from their respective parishes, their circles, to the call of their leader. From Devangel, ancient Baden watched each approach, his magical attunement with the land informing him whenever a brother Samhaste crossed into his domain. Their number swelled to 20, to 30, and finally to 32, meaning that all but one of the Samhastes of Vanguard had survived the last months of war, and that the one dead priest had died gloriously in the first battle of Chapel Pelennor. Ancient Baden was pleased. When they were all gathered together, he gave them a complete tour of the grand, now grander, ice palace he had constructed. He even took them to his room of power at the top of the highest tower, where a well reached deep through the castle floor, deep through the glacier, and deep into the energy of the hot springs far below.
Bask in it!
They did, many nearly swooning in the orgy of earth power of this near-perfect conduit to the Rift of Samhain, the holy lake of Mithranadun. Ancient Baden led the procession out of Devangel and onto Cauldron Glacier. He showed them the work at the chasm, where the white worm god continued its destructive work, where the misting blood of trolls prevented the natural repairs. He even sacrificed a pair of prisoners so that his brethren could hear the feasting of the worm.
Guaidra reinforces from the south.
The speaker was one of the younger Samhasts, whose domain was near to the Gulf of Corona.
Nothing substantial as yet,
but... It will remain nothing substantial. I have been south to Hunts proper. The fighting between Laird Delaval and Laird Ethelbert does not abate. Indeed, it is more furious than ever. I had thought Delaval to be gaining the advantage, but Ethelbert has unleashed legions of bear barbarians. They have cut a fine line across the northern foothills of the Belt and Buckle Mountains, moving so near to Delaval's throne that he was forced to bring back most of his frontline forces who were pressing the city of Ethelbert to Zentel.
That does not bode well. Delaval will not be pushed from his city. He will win out in the end. But now that end seems more distant.
Why do you think that ill?
It prolongs the war.
And?
The pain of war is not unnecessary.
Everyone dies. That some will have their lives shortened is not our concern.
Easy, friend. And?
I only fear that the followers of Abel grow stronger with every passing year of war. Their gemstones are greatly coveted by the lairds, all the lairds, and every man they heal moves them deeper into the heart of the people.
You think in terms of years, young one. Consider the decades before us, the centuries. Fear not, followers of Abel. We will win in the end because we are right. We will win because the order of society depends upon it. There can be no lasting victory for the followers of that fool Abel, because any gains they make unwind the order. They are gentle. They do not inspire fear in the people. Absent that, anarchy ensues. History tells us as much, again and again. As the people begin to lose their fear of the severity of honest justice, they will become lax in their morals. Every woman a whore, every man a fornicator and adulterer. Promises of eternal paradise will not stop a wife from cuckolding her husband. Declarations of a merciful God invite sin, and ultimately anarchy. The monks of Abel will have their day in Hans. They will win, my brothers, but only until the structures of Hunt society fall away. It will take a generation, perhaps a few, but the cuckolds and other victims will call out for us. Do not doubt it. Let the fighting rage south of the Gulf of Hunts. What you perceive as victory for the monks is also the distraction that will prevent Guaidra from gaining help from the lairds. Let them have Hunts proper while we secure ourselves forever in vanguard. We will always be ready, be assured, to answer the pleas of the victims of the concept of a merciful God and the false promises of sweet eternity. Because, my brethren, in the end, it is order that holds civilization together. And because, my brethren, that order needs severity. Go, return to your circles and observe. The trolls and goblins who sweep the land do so because the people of Vanguard deny us. When, in any of your circles, they stop denying us, when they deny Guaidra and her lover, we will redirect our attacks to another circle.
All around him, Samhasts began to bow repeatedly.
We cannot tell the common folk the truth of the monks and their false mercy, because they are too stupid to properly recognize the greater truth, that severe justice to the criminal is mercy to the goodly man. We are the merciful ones. They, the followers of the fool Abel, invite chaos and ruin.
Bond surrounds himself with formidable allies.
Jameson Sequin was explaining to the group of five road-weary heroes.
You should have come north with an army to properly execute your plan.
We could not have supplied such a force. And the attraction it would have wrought would have had us fighting trolls and goblins and barbarians every step of the way.
By the time we reached our goal, if we ever did, we'd be lucky to have even this many remaining.
Then it seems as if your goal was never really in reach, brother. You do not appreciate the power of your enemy. He is Baden, ancient Baden, the ancient of all Samhast. I regard him as God, not without cause. His powers are extreme.
Ever see that monk use his gemstones? Or that one swing that sword of his?
I have, and I was impressed at both. But have you ever witnessed a dragon of despair?
A dragon?
Ancient Baden is near to a god among the Samhast, not without cause. Have you ever battled a giant? Not a big man, but a true giant. You will if you deign to approach Baden. Creatures thrice the height of a tall man and several times his weight, with the power to snap your spine, with the ease that one of us might snap the shaft of an old arrow.
We could not bring an army. Nor can Dame Guaidra's people continue under the duress of Baden's pressing hordes. We know the desperation of our plan, and to a man and woman we accept it. Why can't you?
We should stay to the populated lands as much as possible.
Jameson crouched and drew his dagger, then etched a rough map on the ground.
We can get right into southern Alpinador along a fairly defined road here, just east of the mountains. There are a couple of villages, reasonable Alpinadoran tribes, where we can resupply.
How do we know that they won't send word of us to Baden?
If they even know of Baden, they owe him no allegiance. Do not make the mistake of believing that the Samhast has captured the hearts of the Alpinadorans. They are a proud collection of tribes with their own histories, beliefs, and practices. I know of no Alpinadoran Samhasts, not one.
Yet barbarians have been known among Baden's invading hordes.
Opportunism more than loyalty, I'm certain.
It is too great a risk. Let us keep to the shadows.
The glacier where ancient Baden has made his home is a long and difficult trek, through wild lands that are already beginning to feel the chill of winter.
Brother Jean nodded, and Jameson shrugged his agreement. They set off soon after, heading generally north. They came under the shadows of a range of towering mountains on their west. Though Jameson heeded the demands of Brother Jean, over the next couple of days, they often came in sight of a rudimentary road, and on several occasions, they saw the rising smoke from Alpinadorian campfires.
Grace or muscle?
Vaughna spoke to Crait on one such occasion when Jameson and Brother Jean had moved down to better view a village, leaving Branson and Alcona in full view on the back edge of a bluff.
But I like the way the highwayman moves. It's all like a dance, like the wind under a moon.
But the red-headed one.
Arms to hold a lover aloft. A determined swing that's not to be blocked or parried.
The two men on the bluff turned to regard Crait.
Good thing for you I'm not the type to blush.
To make others blush, though?
Aye, that's the fun of life. Grace or muscle?
The highwayman's got himself a wife, a new one, and a beloved one.
Muscle'll do.
Jameson and Jean returned, and the half-dozen moved along as always and set camp as always. Except that night, Alcona found an unexpected visitor. His step was lighter the next day. One afternoon, as they passed through a stretch of pines and rocks just below the snow line, and in air cold enough so that they could see their breaths, Jameson stopped.
We're being watched. It's been Pinol's tribe. Small in number, but very fierce. They range from the road below the passes above. This is their territory.
Branson put a hand on his sword hilt, a movement Jameson did not miss. The scout shook his head.
We would be foolish to tarry, but they will let us pass as long as we keep going. They trust in my respect of them.
The group continued along single file, and the five, unfamiliar with the land, kept glancing left and right, as if expecting to see painted barbarian warriors hiding behind every tree, spear in hand.
Try not to look so terrified. You'll just make our host nervous.
The rest of the day passed without incident. Jameson kept them high in the mountains that night, and the cold winds howled at them, and a few snowflakes even drifted about. But Jameson Sequin knew this place as well as the Alpinadorians who called it home. He had a blazing fire going and warmed rocks for the five to keep them comfortable as they slept. Branson watched the men carefully long into the night and marveled at the simple serenity on Jameson's face. He seemed fully at peace out here, like a man who had long left behind the trivial troubles of feuding lairds and churches and petty human squabbles. As Jameson sat upon a boulder and stared up at the night sky, Branson got a sense of a man truly at peace, of a man who had found his place in the universe and who seemed truly comfortable in that place. It occurred to Branson that there was something juste too about Jameson Sequin. A thought crossed Branson's mind. For a fleeting moment, he considered the notion that Jameson Sequin might be his father. Was it possible that McKeague was wrong? That Brandenard had survived the road and had used his training from the Walk of Clouds to become this legend in the Northland? He wondered how in the world that notion had infiltrated his mind.
Wishful thinking.
But he wanted Jameson Sequin to be his father. He wanted someone to be his father, particularly someone he could admire. Branson had tried to dismiss the notion that Dawson McKeague's proclamation regarding Brandenard's fate had hurt him profoundly. Jameson walked over and stirred the flames of the low-burning fire. The orange light danced across his weathered face, shadowing his deep wrinkles and reflecting off his thick mustache. Branson saw experience there, and competence, and wisdom, and it only confirmed Branson's earlier recognition of Serenity. This wasn't Brandenard, though Branson wished that it could be true. He would settle for being spiritual companions, if indeed they were. Over the course of the next few days, the road all but disappeared and no more villages spotted the landscape. Jameson's temperament sobered considerably. Taking that lead, the other five began to feel the gravity of their situation. They were getting close, they all believed, though none asked Jameson openly about it. They just did as the scout suggested, moving along in a straight line to the north, a few hundred feet up in the foothills of the seemingly endless mountain range. Jameson had to give them the directions far in advance, for he was increasingly absent from their line, moving all about to scout the region and pick up their course. On one such afternoon, Branson was leading the five through more rows of tall and dark evergreens. Branson pulled up and slid low behind some brush, staring out.
A crack of a whip.
A motion to the side turned them both to the right, where Vonna crouched behind a stump. She looked at them and pointed down and farther to the right. Following her finger, the pair did note some movement along the lower trees, though they couldn't make out anything definite.
Stay here.
Branson waved to Vonna, and then to Alcona and Crate, who were similarly crouching in some brush up above the woman, to do the same. Branson reached inside himself to his geste tout training. He surveyed the landscape falling away before him, and potential paths appeared to him as clearly as if they were drawing it all out on a map. He belly crawled out from the brush, popped up into a crouch, and darted to a tree some 10 feet from Brother Jean. He paused only briefly before rushing out again to his left this time, then down again to a pile of stones before belly crawling his way to a lower stand of trees. Soon, he was out of sight of the others, sliding from shadow to shadow, for it was darker down here with the sun beginning to dip behind the mountains. A long while passed. Movement alerted the four to Branson's return, so they thought, for the form that emerged from some trees in a running crouch was that of Jameson, not Branson. He moved to the pair highest up, and John and Vonna joined him there.
Where's Branson?
Scouting.
A concerned look crossed the scout's face.
What is it then?
Trolls, mostly. Many of them, escorting a line of captured men and women to the north.
How many trolls?
Too many. A score at least. Their line is too long for me to get an accurate count. I dared not tarry, fearing that you five would run down heroically to intervene.
Are you saying that we should not? If there are men and women down there?
The highwayman returns.
They turned as one to see Branson picking a careful path back up the mountainside. He rushed in and skidded down in the midst of the group.
Trolls with prisoners.
So we've been told. Too many trolls, so says Jameson.
You wish to get to Ancient Baden, and we are only a couple of days from his glacial home. If you engage this group here and now, you risk being killed or captured. You also risk having some escape to carry a warning to that most dangerous Samhaste. You have no chance of succeeding if Baden knows you're coming, of course, and little even if he does not. How many trolls are too many trolls in that case?
One troll's too many.
For the greater good, you would ask us to let the prisoners be tortured and murdered?
I'm not envying your choices.
If we hit them hard and fast, we might have them all dead or fleeing in short order.
We've got the high ground to start our attack.
But if any are getting away,
then they'll think we came from the south to rescue the captives. And will they even report the disaster to the Ancient? Would they dare face him with such a failure?
A score, at least.
Then you need only kill 3 or 4 to do your share. We can't let them walk right past us.
There is the greater good to consider.
Spoken like an Abelican, to be sure.
Brother Jean looked to Branson.
We cannot just let them pass. I'd not sleep well on hard ground or soft bed alike for the rest of my days.
True enough, and more. We are arguing as if we've got a choice, and none of us here is thinking that.
Do not underestimate trolls.
Killed a score of the ugly things already. More than that. Let's hit them, and hit them hard.
All heads nodded. Jameson started to lay out a plan, but Branson beat him to it, sending the scout down north of the group to pick off any trolls who would flee that way. With Alcona and Crate moving farthest to the south, Branson, Vaughna, and Brother Jean traveled straight down the hill. Branson took the lead, directing the movements of the other two so that they remained out of sight until they were right above the path, the line of monsters and miserable captives rapidly approaching.
You're not too worn out to give a good fight, are you?
Alcona looked at Crate curiously, even incredulously.
Told you it was a ride worth taking.
Alcona's cheeks turned as red as his hair. With grace and speed and perfectly silently, Jameson moved undetected into position behind a clutch of boulders a dozen feet up from the trail and just ahead of the lead of troll drivers. One in particular caught his eye, a nasty-looking beast with half of its face torn away. It swung a whip easily with practiced efficiency, and the way the others, trolls and not just the miserable prisoners, cowered against its every word told Jameson that this was likely the leader of the group. He drew out his finest arrow and set it to his bowstring.
30 or more.
Brother Jean slid in between Branson and Vaughna, just above the road.
Call it off.
Branson motioned farther back along the troll line to a cluster of the brutes about two-thirds of the way to the end.
Hit them harder.
Vaughna nodded, and even Brother Jean had to concede that they truly had no options here. They had committed. They had made their choice up on the hill. The trolls and prisoners flowed before them. They took up their weapons and set their feet under them. The first strike would be crucial. Alcona and Crate had already surmised the higher-than-expected count and the challenges it would bring. They crouched low behind some brush, glancing over to their left, the north, waiting for the trio to begin the assault. When that delayed longer than expected, the pair wondered if perhaps the added numbers had turned them about. But it was a brief consideration and nothing more, for as the largest cluster of trolls, nearly a dozen, moved under the trio's position, Branson and Vaughna leaped down on them, axes and that fabulous sword swinging hard.
Be quick, for we've got no choice!
The old warrior tugged at Alcona's arm, and the two charged down at the surprised creatures below. The first few frenzied moments of that attack played out exactly as Branson had hoped. He and Vaughna cut deep into the troll ranks, slashing and chopping the group apart.
We are doomed!
Branson managed a moment's reprieve to look that way, and his heart surely sank. Alcona was in full flight, running toward him with a look of utter desperation. Behind him, straddling a dead troll, Crate stood with his back to Branson, his arms up to ward off a barrage of flying spears, and beyond those came the trolls, so many more trolls.
Give them troll weapons! Anything!
A pair of trolls came in hard at him, but Branson was too full of rage at that moment. Branson turned toward the south. Crate was down and squirming. Though it seemed as if he would make it, Alcona lurched suddenly and grabbed at his gaff, where a spear had hit home. He stumbled down to one knee. Another spear clipped him across the side of his neck. He fell face down to the ground, curled and covered. Branson rushed back to Vaughna and Brother Jean, pressed on two sides by trolls. Behind her, Brother Jean lifted his fist and sent forth a bolt of bluish lightning. As he let fly the bolt, so the mob of trolls let fly a volley of rocks, filling the air with missiles, Vaughn was smacked hard by more than one. Branson had better luck twisting and dodging. He ducked a rock coming in at his head. Almost. It clipped him on the forehead and rebounded away.
James Stunton, cover our backs!
Another rock soared in for Branson's head. He ducked fast to the side and came right back up. His bandana and gemstone fell free. Branson staggered and stumbled. The trolls closed in on him, and he tried to lift his sword to strike. He thought of the Book of Shest, tried to recall his lessons, tried to fight through the sudden disconnect between his body and his mind. It was too sudden, too unexpected. Branson stumbled and fumbled. He dropped his sword and didn't even know it, swinging his arm across as if he still held the blade. A rock smacked him in the face. Vaughna and Brother Jean came forward in a rush, protecting Branson. Hardly slowing as she neared, Vaughna bent and scooped up his sword. But before the word even truly registered to Vaughna, she saw the trap, a huge net thrown by a trio of trolls. Instinctively, she lashed at it. Branson's fine sword sliced through one of its thick strands, but more nets were already airborne. The trolls pressed in from in front and from behind. If it had been 20, they might have won. If it had been 30, they might have won. Cormac bent the dead troll over the torso of another dead troll. He tried to find some levity in this gruesome task. In truth, the monk couldn't believe what he was doing here, tying together the bodies of several trolls he had slain into a makeshift raft.
What have you reduced me to, Brother Giovanni?
Using strands of dead plants washed up against the rocks and contorting the stiffening troll bodies to complement each other, he soon enough had his bobbing craft constructed. He warded out with it to where the water was waist deep, then pressed down on it to test its ballast. Dead trolls proved surprisingly buoyant, much more than a human, though of course he had no idea of how long his craft might last. Wouldn't it be fitting for him to float out into the middle of Mithranidune only to discover that troll buoyancy lasted only a short while?
To stay here is to die.
He had no other chances to take. Cormac gathered up the plank of his destroyed boat to use as a paddle and pushed off, drifting into the mist on a squishy pillow of flesh. The plank wasn't much of an oar. Mithranidune's strong crossing currents brought on by the many hot springs that fed the lake and the constant battles between the colder surface water sinking into the heated depths sent Cormac's carrion vessel swirling. The mist proved especially heavy this day, and the man couldn't see more than a few feet in any direction. Eventually, he just surrendered to the whims of the lake and reclined on the troll raft. Sometime later, a slight twitch beneath him surprised him. He moved up to his elbows. The raft twitched again, then again more insistently. Cormac moved to the edge and peered into the dark waters, expecting to see a troll tugging at the raft. He fell back and knew he was horribly doomed, for a great fish had glided by just beneath him, a fish longer than he was tall. He knelt on the center of the macabre raft and took up his paddle. He had to get out of here. He had to get anywhere that was not open water. The raft jerked one way, then shuddered as something large bumped it from below. Suddenly, it began moving sidelong against all of Cormac's efforts, caught not by a current, but by the gigantic fish. He scrambled to the edge, his face blanched as he saw the beast just below him, its large mouth clamped about a dangling troll leg. Cormac took up the plank in both hands and stabbed hard at the fish. Cormac saw the fish swim off with the troll leg in its mouth. The raft continued to spasm as more and more of the huge fish nibbled, bit, and bumped it. The raft was falling apart around him, and when he moved to hold it together, he saw them, the great fish, circling and waiting.
Oh, Giovanni, what have you reduced me to?
Yeah, pull her left, you fool!
Kriminig chastised the four dwarves rowing the boat. Cranky old Kriminig, all gray beard and wrinkled face, stood at the prow, clutching his blood-stained beret, which was the shiniest among the powries of Mithranidun. For none had seen more battles and none had scored more kills than Kriminig. He closed his eyes as the boat began its turn and let his thoughts flow through his beret. All Pauri caps share the magic of bestowing toughness. Wounds healed faster for the wearer, and the brighter a beret, the more cushion it would offer to its wearer. A few of those berets gained added benefits as the layers of blood on the fabric and wisdom of experience for the wearer brought added insight. For dwarves like Kriminig, the berets could serve almost as beacons, though weak lights in a thick fog, where he could sense the magic of another Pauri cap. An injured dwarf would spark the magic, and that magic resonated. Out on the lake fishing this day, Kriminig had felt such a pang, and though curious that it was coming from a direction opposite to their home island and far distant, and though he was confident that no dwarves other than the eight on his boat were off the island, he was certain of the feeling.
A Pauri's in trouble!
But our kin are all back at home!
Then more have come to the lake!
The debate went round and round, and only one on the boat knew that he had an answer to the curious riddle. But McQuiggick, sitting in the back with the fishing net, thought it best to keep his suspicions to himself. A couple of the others, though, had heard rumors about Praganag's cap and cast curious glances McQuiggick's way.
Just keep rowing. There might be something interesting to find.
Too much left! Ease her back to starboard!
Cormac looked around frantically, lifting his head as much as possible, though he didn't dare stand or even kneel on the rocking troll raft. Even if he spotted another island, Cormac knew that he was doomed. There was no way he could outswim these giant fish, even if he managed to surprise them and get a good lead as he had done with the Pauris. One came up right before him and bit at a troll hand protruding in the air. Another came up and bit him on the side of his cap, tearing his skin. He swung about fast and slammed his fist into the side of the fish. While that action did send the thing back under the water, the movement also further diminished the integrity of the raft. Another troll body broke free, leaving Cormac on only three remaining ragged corpses. He felt his robes weighing him down as he often bobbed into the water, and he thought to take them off. To what point? All the fear and the anger went away then suddenly. Resigned to his fate, Cormac stopped himself from removing the soaked and heavy robes. He would let them drag him down to the depths. Better to surrender to it and get it over with. In the distance, he heard an oar dipping into the lake. A fish as long as Cormac was tall leaped up before him, coming for his face. But the agile monk reacted with fury and speed, smashing it in the side of the head with the right cross that turned it aside. The strike threw him off balance, and now he was in the water, the troll bodies all floating apart. His robes pulled him down as he worked his weary arms furiously to try to tread water. He tilted his head back as far as he could. A strong hand grabbed his shoulder, though, and hauled him back up. Then he was lying on the wood, eyes closed, only semi-conscious, and curled defensively.
Well, what do we got here?
A name's Cormac. Won the cap, fair and square.
So take the cap and throw the fool back to the Mithraut.
Don't let him fall.
Brother Jean and Vanna struggled to keep Branson marching in the line of prisoners.
What is wrong with him?
He got hit too hard in the head.
It was the eighth time he had answered that same question to Vanna and to Alcona, whom he was now helping along the march. Alcona had taken a few fairly serious hits, and John initially feared that he would not survive. Most of those wounds had proven superficial, though, and Alcona's growing reputation for toughness had proven well earned. Now, though, in pain and needing support, he moved along without a whimper of complaint. Branson listened to the conversations very distantly. He had thought to slur out some rudimentary explanation early on in the march, but had foregone the effort, realizing that there was nothing his companions could do. Brother Jean had retrieved the bandana, but the soul stone was not to be found. and the trolls had stripped the monk of all his possessions, particularly the magical gemstones. Crait lay dead back at the scene of the battle. All of the four surviving heroes sent by Dame Guaidra had been hurt, Branson the least of all, Alcona by far the worst. But without the gemstone, Branson couldn't count himself as fortunate. Their only hope was Jameson. Only Jameson Sequin could get them out of this. The next day, the line of prisoners was marched through a long, descending, barren pass overlooking a river of blue-white ice. As they neared the base of that path, the ground became more slippery, and no matter how hard he focused or how hard Vana tried to help him, Branson fell repeatedly. The first time, he thought his long trial would end with the trolls descending upon him to whip him to death. But many of the weary humans were slipping and falling. Unbeknownst to Branson and the others, they were too close to their destination for the trolls to allow any to die. They moved out of the Rocky Mountain Pass and onto the glacial sheet, and surprisingly, the footing was actually better here and far more consistent than on the ice-speckled mountain trail. They had trudged on for nearly an hour when, to the southeast, a large castle appeared as if made completely of ice. Glistening minarets and towers reached up from the foreboding bluish, nearly translucent walls. Dread emanated from the group, both from the scope and aura of sheer power emanating from the castle beyond, and because this was the first time that any of them had actually looked upon a giant. These were giants, as Jameson had warned, and not simply large humans. Thrice Branson's height, the behemoth humanoid creatures mocked his warrior pride. No matter how fine he became with his weapon, no matter how strong he honed his muscles, no matter how fine and precise his reactions, how could he ever hope to do battle against such a behemoth?
No!
Before him lay the ultimate challenge, the final pinnacle, perhaps. He had no doubt that this was the abode of ancient Baden, the key to his freedom, or, more likely by far, he now understood the gateway to the afterlife. Bound, dirty, cold, and bone-weary, the prisoners were forced into a side-by-side line out in the middle of the glacier, just south of the enormous ice castle that graced the mountainside on the eastern edge of the ice river, and just before an enormous chasm in the glacial ice. Not far away, a pair of giants pounded wedges deep into the ice, but even their brute force could not intimidate the prisoners more than the old, but hardly feeble man who stood before them. Branson knew it to be ancient Baden. The sheer power exuded by the old man, a commanding presence that seemed to mock any who stood near to him, reminded Branson clearly of his long-ago encounter with the imposing Bernivagar. Only this one was stronger, he understood. Much stronger. The prisoners tried hard not to meet Baden's withering gaze, but whenever one did, he or she knew true hopelessness.
Him first!
The Samhaste pointed to Alcona, who was doing much better than his friends had anticipated.
Take the rest away. Keep them alive, and keep them miserable that they will more welcome their deaths.
A trio of trolls grabbed Alcona and hustled him forward. When he tried to resist, they tripped him face down to the ice. When Alcona rolled to his side, he left a stream of bright red blood on the blue-white surface. Branson glanced at ancient Baden to gauge his response. If the man had even noted Alcona's fall, he didn't show it. Instead, his gaze had locked on a troll off to the side, the one that carried Branson's sword strapped diagonally across its back. The Samhaste stared at it curiously for just a moment, then reached out his hand and grasped suddenly, as if he were grabbing the troll by the throat. And indeed, magically, he had done just that from the way the creature suddenly stiffened and reached up with its own hands. Ancient Baden retracted his hand, and the troll stumbled toward him at such an angle that it obviously would have fallen over had not the Samhaste's magic been holding it on its feet. As the troll came in, Baden grabbed it by the throat with his real hand, and with surprisingly little effort lifted the squirming creature into the air and turned it about. He regarded the decorated sword for only a moment before pulling it free, then dropped the troll back to the ground. Ancient Baden's eyes sparkled as he studied the magnificent weapon. He pushed the troll away and took up the sword in both hands, waving it before his eyes. His expression, that of someone who had just realized a great treasure. Branson managed to keep from throwing himself off balance as he glanced back to note Baden's souring expression, to see the Samhays bring the sword blade up horizontally under his nose. Ancient Baden calmly walked over and spoke not to Branson, but to Vonna at his side.
I am told you wielded this blade in the fight.
I did.
This blade has the scent of the blood of a Samhaist elder on it. This blade killed a friend of mine.
I only acquired it recently. I never met a Samhaist elder.
Ah, you have now.
Without warning, he stabbed the sword into Vonna's belly. Her eyes registered shock briefly before she doubled over, holding her spilling guts, and sank to one knee. A troll ran to retrieve a rope, looped over a pulley at the end of a beam that was hanging out over the chasm. Branson and the others watched in horror as the trolls tied the rope around Vonna's ankle and dragged her to the edge of the chasm and left her there as Ancient Baden strolled over, sword still in hand. The trolls around the prisoners began hurting them again, but Baden stopped them.
Let them watch!
Hot with horror and revulsion, Branson fell within himself. He fought to find his jested two edge to cry out that it was his sword. Branson looked up in surprise to see that it was Brother Jean's fist and not that of a troll.
Do not insult her sacrifice.
Ancient Baden stood on the ledge before Vonna, his arms upraised.
Crema es nocte verat ex nos! Fronti veaste nat fallon destra nat gestva firva domne!
Hanging over the chasm, Vonna looked down and her face drained of all color, despite being upside down. The trolls turned the crank, easing the woman a long, long way down. Suddenly, the rope jerked so forcefully that the heavy beam bent and seemed as if it would break. It held, and the trolls began hauling up the rope. No need for the crank anymore.
Justice is done. They're wanting you to use your long legs and wade out for better fishing.
McQuiggick spoke to Cormac. The man sat on a large rock on the northeastern side of the Powry's nearly barren island, staring at the misty waters.
We're not gonna kill you. I mean, not unless you do something asking for us to kill you.
I do appreciate the rescue and your generosity in allowing me to live.
Well, I'm thinking that the bosses are wanting Prague's son to get old enough to see if the boy can win his dead father's cat back.
The bosses? Aren't you one of the bosses?
Yeah, but I'm wanting to keep you alive just because.
Just because?
Despite his troubling situation, Cormac managed a little grin at that cryptic admission from the rough Powry. He had grown somewhat fond of the dwarf.
You don't give us any reason to kill you, and we won't kill you. Now go get us some fish.
And what happens when you go to battle? When the Powrys row out to do battle with the monks or the Alpinadorans, what am I to do?
You're a long way from getting us to let you go along.
I could never go to such a fight, and you know it well.
Yeah, but you fight them barbarians all the time.
Not by my choice. Never by my choice. Not against them and not against you Powrys.
I'm knowing you better than to think you're afraid of a fight.
There is no point to the fighting.
Oh, no! Oh, how about the trolls, then?
I'll help you kill all the trolls you can find.
Yeah, we seen what was left of your boat. Darndest boat any of us ever seen. It might be a big part of why others are letting you stay.
But I cannot stay.
Oh, up for a long swim, are you?
I cannot remain here for long, anyway. This is no place for me.
You're wanting us to put you back with the monks? Aye. Might that we can, but that you'll have to earn. So go get the fish and keep getting the fish.
I can never go back there. They would not have me, and I would not have them.
They set me adrift, thinking they had left me for dead. But somehow I did not die.
Not somehow, you dort. Was a cap on your head. So you're not wanting to go back there, and you're saying you can't stay here.
Your son, Fear.
The barbarians?
Yes. I would have you drop me there.
They'll kill you!
Nevertheless, that is where I would like to go.
Well, you ain't for going there with us. Not a place we go near. Those folks ain't like your monk friends. They know the water and know when anything's near their island. They've been there 100 years, you know, and more, lots more. They're not using stones to throw lightning like your own. Ah, their magic's quieter, but worse for us if we venture near.
Then give me a boat so I can go there alone.
You're daft. Boats are worth more than yourself.
I will return in short order.
Oh, then how are you getting back to their island after you drop it back here?
I'm not going back to that island or any island.
Oh?
This has never been my place.
What are you saying, boy? Now, say it plain.
I have a friend, several perhaps, on Yosunfia, who wishes to be gone from this lake. Lend me a boat so I can retrieve her.
Her? Oh, that's telling me a lot.
We'll come right back with the boat. Then, with your agreement, you can take us to the shore and never think of us again.
McGuigick started to respond in several different directions. Cormac gathered this by the way the dwarf's mouth worked in weird circles with no real sounds coming out.
Just catch us some darned fish!
Cormac had no idea what all that might be about, so he took up the net and waded into the warm lake waters.
You keep looking out to the south.
Andrusus walked up beside Milkayla.
You fear that something has happened to him. We took care to make it appear as if our escape had been of our doing. I doubt that our friend's complicity is known to the monks.
And yet he does not signal in any way.
Andrusus put a hand on her shoulder to comfort her.
Your duties!
They broke away from each other and turned as one to regard the shaman who was striding their way.
You spend far too much time seeking an Abelican.
An Abelican who saved us.
It is true, then, what they say. You have fallen for this Abelican named Cormac.
He is a friend. A loyal one.
Friend. A mere friend does not betray his own brethren. Nay, there is more at work here than friendship. His betrayal bespeaks fires in his loins.
Milkayla didn't respond at all, didn't blink or sneer or speak.
Your duties await. You would do well to prove yourself.
I am shaman.
For now.
The warning did indeed shake the woman, visibly so, and she turned and hurried away.
And you would do well to learn and accept your place. My patience nears its end for Andrusus. I took you to dangerous waters. Men of honor paid with their lives.
Andrusus' stunned expression spoke volumes, clearly arguing that the disaster on the boat was hardly his fault.
We went out of our way to try to save you, young and spirited one. But no more. Prove yourself, or you will be banished. If you are fortunate and the elders are feeling generous.
Yes, Tonuke.
A somber mood accompanied Brother Giavno and the rest as they went to work collecting the larger stones from the area of the island they had come to regard as their quarry. Giavno winced and couldn't help but recall the last time he had been down here, when Paris had arrived and Cormac had battled them so magnificently, so bravely. The loss of Cormac was no small thing to the brothers of Chapel Isle. The manner in which it had occurred had left them all, particularly Giavno, tasked with delivering the very likely final beating, feeling empty and desolate. No one had spoken the fallen brother's name since he had been pushed out adrift in the small boat. No one had to. It was written on all of their faces, Giavno clearly saw. To a one they had been shaken. To a one, Cormac's betrayal had asked primary and devastating questions about their purpose and place in this foreign land and among these foreign societies. Why had Cormac done it? Why had the man betrayed them, betrayed the very tenets of their mission? Giavno thought he had the answer to that, echoed in the sounds of Cormac's lovemaking to the barbarian woman. Love was the strongest of human emotions, Blessed Abel had taught, and more people had been brought down by love than by hate. While there was no specific prohibition of marriage in the Order of Blessed Abel, such relationships were scorned among the Brotherhood. Cormac had earned his beating, Giavno believed, and had told himself countless times since that awful day. He could still feel the tug of the whip as its barbed ends dug into and hooked on the flesh of Cormac's back. He shuddered, and only then realized that one of the brothers had been asking him a question, and probably for some time.
Yes, brother?
The stone?
Stone.
The monk offered a curious stare at Giavno for just a moment, then nodded as if he completely understood and motioned toward one large rock that had been set off to the side.
Is it too large, do you think?
No, of course not.
I cannot carry it alone.
Then get someone to help you.
They are all busy, Brother Giavno. I thought that perhaps you could help, either with your arms or through use of the malachite stone in lessening the weight.
Giavno was about to reprimand the brother for being so foolish. Giavno was overseeing the work detail and not participating. But then he caught something in the young brother's eye, a look of both hopefulness and sympathy. And when he glanced out at the wider scene, he realized that more than one of the other workers had taken a subtle, covert interest in this distant conversation. Brother Giavno smiled as it hit him fully. They were trying to distract him. As the work was keeping their minds off the tragedy of Brother Cormac, so they had thought to include Brother Giavno in that blessed busyness.
Yes, brother, come. Together we two will carry the stone to the chapel, and what a fine addition to the wall it will be.